Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. This week we have a special show for you. We normally have a single guest on the show and take an in-depth look at their research and hear their choice of songs. Today, instead, I have for you a selection of quotations and recordings from scientists of the past. I'm hoping this selection will give us some insight into their own view of their work, of science in general, and even the fate of the world. I've made this particular selection because these scientists have made a massive impact to the world of science, but also to me personally. This is a group of thinkers and discoverers that would probably feature in my fantasy dinner party, where all the guests can be anyone past and present. Really, science is built on the work of all those that came before us, and to paraphrase my first dinner guest, we see further by merely standing on the shoulders of giants. And here are a few of the biggest. First today, we're going to hear from Sir Isaac Newton. Newton was most famous for his seminal work, Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, in which he laid down the first description of the laws of motion and first described the law of gravity. It's this law of gravity and the apocryphal apple story which dominates the public conscience, but he also made significant discoveries in optics, mathematics, and invented the first reflecting telescope. He was later president of the Royal Society, as well as being master of the Mint. It's in this quote, taken from Memoirs of the Life, Writings and Scientific Discoveries of Sir Isaac Newton by David Brewster, Newton describes his own view of his work.
I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore, and diverting myself in now and then, finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me.
Very modest. So for Newton, I've chosen the Venus and Adonis Overture by John Blow. Newton, as a contemporary of Blow, may very well have heard this piece, and they both share a resting place, Westminster Abbey. Our next quotation is from Ada Lovelace. Lovelace was always described as Lord Byron's daughter, but she ought to be known for her mathematical contributions to what was essentially the first computer. The mechanical device invented by Charles Babbage was designed to calculate values of mathematical functions in order to tabulate their results. It was Lovelace, however, that saw the true potential of the machine as a means of calculations that could expand the limits of the human mind. And her descriptions of it showed an understanding that was at least the same and probably deeper than her more well-known inventor. The words we hear are taken from Scientific Memoirs, edited by Richard Taylor, as an extract originally attributed to L.F. Manabrow.
Those labours which belong to the various branches of the mathematical sciences, although on first consideration they may seem to be the exclusive province of intellect, may, nevertheless, be divided into two distinct sections, one of which may be called the mechanical, because it is subjected to precise and invariable laws that are capable of being expressed by means of the operations of matter, while the other, demanding the intervention of reasoning, belongs more specially to the domain of the understanding. This admitted, we may propose to execute, by means of machinery, the mechanical branch of these labours, reserving for pure intellect that which depends on the reasoning faculties. Thus the rigid exactness of those laws which regulate numerical calculations must frequently have suggested the employment of material instruments, either for executing the whole of such calculations or for abridging them, and thence have arisen several inventions having this object in view, but which have in general but partially attained it. For instance, the much admired machine of Pascal is now simply an object of curiosity, which, whilst it displays the powerful intellect of its inventor, is yet of little utility in itself. Its powers extended no further than the execution of the four first operations of arithmetic, and indeed were in reality confined to that of the two first, since multiplication and division are merely the result of a series of additions and subtractions. The chief drawback hitherto on most of such machines is that they require the continual intervention of a human agent to regulate their movements, and thence arises a source of errors, so that, if their use has not become general for large numerical calculations, it is because they have not in fact resolved the double problem which the question presents, that of correctness in the results united with economy of time.
Such a brilliant insight into the very beginnings of computing. Ada actually spoke Italian, and her contributions to the difference engine started out as a paper by the Italian engineer Manabro. She made some notes on those and extended them, which turned into a later book. So she may have heard this piece by Giuseppe Verdi, Messa di Gloria, which was written when Lovelace was 24 and 12 years before her death, aged only 36. Marie Sklodowska Curie is well known as the first person in history to receive two Nobel Prizes in both chemistry and physics. She discovered two elements, polonium and radium, and did extensive research into radioactivity. The quote we're about to hear is from her later work. During World War I, she developed mobile X-ray units to deliver medical care right up to the front lines, and deftly showed how research that was initially purely for discovery could be taken on and applied to life-saving medical procedures. The following is from Madame Curie, translated by Vincent Sheehan.
The story of radiology in war offers a striking example of the unsuspected amplitude that the application of purely scientific discoveries can take under certain conditions. X-rays had only a limited usefulness up to the time of the war. The great catastrophe which was let loose upon humanity, accumulating its victims in terrifying numbers, brought up by a reaction the ardent desire to save everything that could be saved, and to exploit every means of sparing and protecting human life. At once there appeared an effort to make an X-ray yield its maximum of service. What had seemed difficult became easy, and received an immediate solution. The material and the personnel were multiplied as if by enchantment. All those who did not understand gave in or accepted. Those who did not know learned. Those who had been indifferent became devoted. Thus the scientific discovery achieved the conquest of its natural field of action. A similar evolution took place in radiotherapy, or the medical application of radiations emitted by the radio elements. What are we to conclude from this unhoped-for development shared between the new radiations revealed to us by science at the end of the 19th century? It seems that they must make our confidence in disinterested research more alive and increase our reverence and admiration for it.
Maria Sklodowska Curie was born in Poland and named one of the elements she discovered polonium after her homeland, even though the country didn't even exist at the time. It was under Russian, German and Austro-Hungarian rule. So for Curie, I've chosen one of Frédéric Chopin's Polish songs. This is Opus 74. Thank you. Next, we have an extract from an interview given by Bertrand Russell. Russell was variously a philosopher, a logician, a writer, and a political activist. After being a pacifist in the First World War, he reluctantly supported the Second, and after became a strident anti-nuclear activist, even spending several days in Brixton Prison for breach of the peace, aged 89. This interview was conducted by Woodrow Wyatt, and was put out by Cademon Records in the early 1960s.
Lord Russell, what is philosophy?
Well, that's a very controversial question. I think no two philosophers will give you the same answer. My own view would be that philosophy consists of speculations about matters where exact knowledge is not yet possible. But that will never be my answer, not anybody else's.
What's the difference between philosophy and science?
Well, roughly you'd say science is what we know and philosophy is what we don't know. That's a simple definition. And for that reason, Christians are perpetually passing over from philosophy into science as knowledge advances.
When something is established and discovered, it ceases to be philosophy and becomes science.
Yes. And all sorts of questions that used to be labelled philosophy are no longer so labelled.
What good is philosophy?
I think philosophy has two uses, really. One of them is to keep alive speculation about things that are not yet amenable to scientific knowledge. After all, scientific knowledge covers a very small part of the things that interest mankind and ought to interest them. There are a great many things of immense interest about which science, at present at any rate, has nothing to say. And I don't want people's imaginations to be limited and enclosed within what can be now known. And I think to enlarge your imaginative purview of the world into the hypothetical realm is one of the uses of philosophy. There's another use which I think is equally important, which is to show that there are things we thought we knew and don't know. On the one hand, to keep us thinking about things that we may come to know, and on the other hand, to keep us modestly aware of how much it seemed like knowledge isn't knowledge.
Could you give some illustrations of the sorts of subjects which have been speculated about and then produce the material result later?
Yes, it's quite easy to do so, especially from Greek philosophy. The Greeks invented a whole lot of hypotheses which turned out valuable later, but which in their day couldn't be tested. Take, for example, the atomic hypothesis. Democritus invented the atomic hypothesis that matter consists of little atoms. And after about 2,000 years, and rather more than that, it turned out that this was the right scientific view. But in his day, it was merely a suggestion. Or take again Aristarchus. Aristarchus was the first person who suggested that the Earth went round the Sun, and not the Sun round the Earth, and that the apparent revolution of the heavens every day was due to the Earth rotating. And that remained as an almost buried and forgotten hypothesis until the time of Copernicus, 2,000 years later. But Copernicus would probably never have thought of it if it hadn't been for Aristarchus.
How is this done? By some sort of intuition?
Oh, no, because the people who first think of these hypotheses can't say this is the truth. They can only say this may be the truth. And if you have a good scientific imagination, you can think of all sorts of things that might be true. And that's the essence of science.
Russell once said, "The human body has evolved and adapted according to the leisurely pace of the seasons. the ultra-fast speed of modernity and the quest for convenience have numbed our patience and obscured the virgin of stagnancy. The boringness in classical music can help us to retrieve our long-forgotten tolerance for life's unexciting moments and discover those moment opportunities for fruitful contemplation. So for him, I have chosen Boring Elgar, a serenade for strings for us to contemplate. G.H. Hardy is, by his own admission in the quote that follows, not very successful mathematician. He was known as the mathematician who mentored Srinivasa Ramanujan, who made significant contributions to number theory and to pure mathematics. He also wrote the book A Mathematician's Apology, a phenomenal insight into the mind of a working mathematician. This book certainly changed the way I feel or felt about mathematics, but I'll let Hardy tell you in his own words with some extracts from that very book.
I have never done anything useful. No discovery of mine has made, or is likely to make, indirectly or directly, for good or ill, the least difference to the amenity of the world. I have helped to train other mathematicians, but mathematicians of the same kind as myself, and their work has been, so far at any rate as I have helped them to it, as useless as my own. Judged by all practical standards, the value of my mathematical life is nil, and outside mathematics it is trivial, anyhow. I have just one chance of escaping a verdict of complete triviality, that I may be judged to have created something worth creating. And that I have created is undeniable. The question is about its value. The case for my life, then, or for that of anyone else who has been a mathematician in the same sense which I have been one, is this, that I have added something to knowledge, and helped others to add more, and that these somethings have a value which differs in degree only, and not in kind, from that of the creations of the great mathematicians, or of any of the other artists, great or small, who have left some kind of memorial behind them.
A great comfort to the mediocre scientists among us. Also here is Hardy's take on the popularity of mathematics in general.
The fact is that there are few more popular subjects than mathematics. Most people have some appreciation of mathematics, just as most people can enjoy a pleasant tune. And there are probably more people really interested in mathematics than in music. Appearances suggest the contrary, but there are easy explanations. Music can be used to stimulate mass emotion, while mathematics cannot. And musical incapacity is recognized, no doubt rightly, as mildly discreditable, whereas most people are so frightened of the name of mathematics that they are ready, quite unaffectedly, to exaggerate their own mathematical stupidity.
In that last quote, Hardy mentioned a pleasant tune, so for him I've chosen a pleasant tune called Let the People Sing by Billy Scott Coomer, and this is from 1940, which is actually the year that Hardy published his apology.
If I were king for a day, to my advisors I'd say, within my kingdom is found much sadness around. Let music come to our aid. Command that music be made. Let all the people parade. This shall be my decree. Let the the people sing, sing like anything, any sort of song they choose.
Next, I'm going to play an extract of an interview with Richard Feynman. Feynman was a physicist who managed to reformulate quantum mechanics into a novel form during his PhD, which is a formidable feat, an achievement that's the envy of anyone who's managed to get to the end of such a qualification. Feynman was a brilliant physicist and even more brilliant teacher. He ended up working at Los Alamos on the first nuclear bomb and cracked safes there as a bit of a joke. But the clip that I've chosen is more to do with his teaching, and I feel like this is because it's so obvious to me how, when asked a question, which appears to be a simple question, he somehow manages to understand the question better than the person asking it. So this is from a BBC archive recording of an interview on Fun to Imagine in 1983.
If you get hold of two magnets and you push them, you can feel this pushing between them. Turn it around the other way and they slam together. Now, what is it, the feeling between those two magnets?
What do you mean, what's the feeling between
the
two magnets?
There's something there, isn't there? I mean, the sensation is that there's something there when you push these two magnets together.
Listen to my question. What is the meaning when you say that there's a feeling? Of course you feel it. Now, what do you want to know?
What I want to know is what's going on.
The
between these two bits, of metal,
magnets repel each other.
And, well, then, what does that mean, or why are they doing that, or how are they doing it?
You're asking.
I must say, I think that's a perfectly reasonable question.
Of course,
to
it's
ask.
A reason. It's an excellent question. Okay. But the problem that you're asking, you see, when you ask why something happens. How does a person answer why something happens? For example, Aunt Minnie is in a hospital. Why? Because she went out and she slipped on the ice and broke her hip. That satisfies people. It satisfies, but it wouldn't satisfy someone who came from another planet, knew nothing about things. First, you understand why. When you break your hip, do you go to the hospital? How do you get to the hospital when the hip is broken? Well, because her husband, seeing that she had the hip was broken, called the hospital up and sent somebody to get her. All that is understood by people. Now, when you explain a why, you have to be in some framework that you allow something to be true. Otherwise, you're perpetually asking why. Why did the husband call up the hospital? Because husband is interested in his wife's welfare. Not always. Some husbands aren't interested in their wife's welfare when they're drunk and they're angry. And so you begin to get a very interesting understanding of the world and all its complications. In order to if you try to follow anything up, you go deeper and deeper in various directions. If, for example, you could go, well, why did she slip on the ice? Well, ice is slippery. Everybody knows that. No problem. But you ask, why is ice slippery? That's kind of curious. Ice is extremely slippery. It's very interesting. You say, how does it work? You could either say, I'm satisfied that you've answered me, ice is slippery, that explains it. Or you could go on and say, why is ice slippery? And then you're involved with something, because there aren't many things as slippery as ice. It's very hard to get greasy stuff, but that's sort of wet and slimy. But a solid that's so slippery? Because it is in the case of ice that when you stand on it, they say, momentarily, the pressure melts the ice a little bit, so you got a sort of instantaneous water surface on which you're slipping. Why on ice and not on other things? Because ice expands when it, water expands when it freezes, so the pressure tries to undo the expansion and melts it. It's capable of melting it. But other substances contract when they're freezing, and when you push them, they're just as satisfied to be solid. Why does water expand when it freezes and other substances don't expand when they freeze? All right? I'm not answering your question, but I'm telling you how difficult a why question is. You have to know what it is that you're permitted to understand and allow to be understood and known, and what it is you're not. You'll notice in this example that the more I ask why, it gets interesting after all. That's my idea, that the deeper a thing is, the more interesting it is. And we could even go further and say, why did she fall down when she slipped? That has to do with gravity. It involves in all the planets and everything else. Never mind. It goes on and on. Now, when you ask, for example, why two magnets repel, there are many different levels. It depends on whether you're a student of physics or an ordinary person that doesn't know anything or not. If you're somebody who doesn't know anything at all about it, all I can say is that there's a magnetic force that makes them repel and that you're feeling that force. And you say, but that's very strange because I don't feel kind of force like that in other circumstances. When you turn them the other way, they attract. There's a very analogous force, electrical force, which is the same kind of a question. And you say, that's also very weird. But you're not at all disturbed by the fact that when you put your hand on the chair, it pushes you back. But we found out by looking at it that that's the same force, as a matter of fact, the electrical force, not magnetic exactly in that case, but it's the same electrical repulsions that are involved in keeping your finger away from the chair, because everything's made out of its electrical forces in minor and microscopic details. There's other forces involved, but this is connected to electrical forces. It turns out that the magnetic and the electric force with which I wish to explain these things, this repulsion in the first place, is what ultimately is the deeper thing that we have to start, that we can start with, to explain many other things that looked like they were, everybody would just accept them. You know, you can't put your hand through the chair. That's taken for granted. But that you can't put your hand through the chair when looked at more closely, why it involves these same repulsive forces that appear in magnets. The situation you then have to explain is why in magnets it goes over a bigger distance than it ordinarily. And there it has to do with the fact that in iron, all the electrons are spinning in the same direction. They all get lined up, and they magnify the effect of the force until it's large enough at a distance that you can feel it. But it's a force which is present all the time and very common and is in a basic force of almost, I mean, I can go a little further back if I were more technical, but at an early level, I just have to tell you that's going to be one of the things you'll just have to take as an element in the world, the existence of magnetic repulsion or electrical attraction, magnetic attraction. I can't explain that attraction in terms of anything else that's familiar to you. For example, if we say the magnets attract like as if they were connected by rubber bands, I would be cheating you. Because they're not connected by rubber bands, I shouldn't be in trouble. You'd soon ask me about the nature of the band. And secondly, if you were curious enough, you'd ask me why rubber bands tend to pull back together again, and I would end up explaining that in terms of electrical forces, which are the very things that I'm trying to use the rubber bands to explain, so I have cheated very badly, you see. So I'm not going to be able to give you an answer to why magnets attract each other, except to tell you that they do. And to tell you that that's one of the elements in the world of the different kinds of forces. There are electrical forces, magnetic forces, gravitational forces, and others. And those are some of the parts. If you were a student, I could go further. I could tell you that the magnetic forces are related to the electrical forces very intimately. That our relationship between the gravity forces and electrical forces remains unknown. And so on. But I really can't do a good job, any job, of explaining magnetic force in terms of something else that you're more familiar with, because I don't understand it in terms of anything else that you're more familiar with.
So he really speaks there like a bit of an arrogant physicist, but a brilliant one nonetheless. Feynman also played the bongos, and his song choice is one of his own, with his friend and fellow bongo player, Ralph Layton. I think maybe this shows you how Feynman was also maybe a little bit crazy. That was Richard Feynman there, clearly really, really wanting some orange juice. And my final contribution comes from Carl Sagan. Sagan was an astrophysicist and a science communicator. His Cosmos series, which if you haven't seen, you have to see, and has been viewed by 500 million people. It inspired a generation of scientists to look up at the stars. And here we're hearing an interview from a CNN interview with Ted Turner in 1989, where he's about to be asked about the state of the planet and what has to be done about it.
We're destroying the ozone layer. We're heating up the earth. We're destroying our forests. We're poisoning the groundwater with radioactive waste and pesticides. How do we ever get in this mess, and is there any way out? Well, how's that for a start?
That's a good question. Well, we got into the mess by not paying attention and by business as usual. Humans have been on this planet for something like 1 million years, and for the vast bulk of that time, things changed extremely slowly. The population increased very slowly. Our technology increased, improved, but by very slow steps. And just recently, you know, this is what's called an exponential. It's flat for a long time, and then, boom, you suddenly get a huge increase. Increase in population, increase in technology, increase in pollution, increase in our powers to disturb the environment, to change the planetary environment. But we're the same old human beings as we were 1,000 years ago and 100,000 years ago. Not much has changed with us. And so it's very hard for us to catch on. That there's a new situation and we have to adapt to it. On the other hand, that's one thing we humans are good at, adapting, figuring out. We're smart. That's our principal advantage over all the other species. I mean, we're not faster, stronger, better diggers. We don't fly all by ourselves. What we do is figure out and build because of our hands. And so I think there's certainly a chance of getting out of this mess, but not by business as usual, not by the idea that that we shouldn't plan ahead, not by the idea that anybody can do whatever the hell they want and it doesn't affect the environment. There has to be a new way of looking at the world. A lot of those issues that you raised are global issues. For example, global warming, the greenhouse effect. You put gases like carbon dioxide or CFCs, other greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere over this country, they don't stay over that country. Those molecules don't have passports. They don't know about national sovereignty. That's something they never heard of. The atmospheric circulation spreads those gases all over the planet. And so what one country does affects all the other countries. The solution to these kinds of problems has to be that everybody on Earth works together. The industrialized nations have the biggest responsibility because they're the biggest polluters. The United States puts more CO2 in the atmosphere than any other nation. But Western Europe and the Soviet Union and Japan and even the developing countries all make significant contributions. So there has to be a new way of looking at the future, and that is that we're all humans, members of the same species, on one fragile little planet. We're all in this together, and we have to work together. That's kind of the silver lining of these crises. They are forcing us to become a planetary species.
Carl Sagan there with some very wise words about becoming a planetary species. Now, luckily Carl has already made his own musical selection, and in fact here he is to introduce it. This is taken from Desert Island Discs in 1981.
It is an exquisite performance by Arthur Grumio of one movement of the Bach Partita No. 3 for unaccompanied violin.
So that's the end of the tour through the guests that I could never get on the show, even if I wanted to. But thankfully, their work is still around that we can experience. This week, you've heard the voice of Sam Wolfe as Sir Isaac Newton and G.H. Hardy, Tammy Hale as Ada Lovelace, and Yulia Benyevska as Marie Curie. You can listen to this show and any of our others as a podcast by searching the usual podcast distributors. We have had a little bit of a different show today. Let us know what you think by getting in touch at Science Mixtape. I've been Kyle Major, and we're going to finish on one of my choices. This is First Aid Kit with Emmy Lou. Thank you, and goodbye.